Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders in sustainable and impact investment, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness and highlight best practices in order to help us transition more capital into the industry faster. I am JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners, and we are the proud sponsors of the podcast. ILM Partners is an advisory and soon-to-launch multi-asset management firm targeting to acquire and scale investment funds focused on sustainability and impact. Our mission is to facilitate and accelerate the transition of £5 billion of capital to sustainable impact investing in the next 5 years. If you would like to explore the opportunity of working together, email contact@ilaandpartners.com for an introductory and confidential conversation. Your support means everything to us, since it's what really keeps us going. So make sure you share our work with someone that will benefit from it. Please remember to subscribe to get the notifications and check the notes from each episode. We hope you enjoy today's special conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is well, healthy, and safe. Today's episode of Impact Leaders is the fourth on our new series called The Sustainable Investment Dilemma, looking into how industries can help address the climate and social crisis, in particular, the financial industry, taking on the opportunity to address the way it has funded the activities that have put us in our current situation. And to continue with the series, our guest today is Craig Goggett. Hello, Craig. Welcome, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Delighted to be here.
Where are you at this moment? Just for context and to ignite people's imagination.
I am in Colorado, my first COVID vacation, skiing and snowshoeing with my family.
And for those that get to watch the video, we're going to put on YouTube and on our website, you will see there's a beautiful place through the window. There's a really nice back window and you can see the mountains. It's the first time that we have somebody from Colorado.
Beaver Creek and Vail, we're in Beaver Creek, but we go back and forth between the two, and it relates to some of my past, because when I would, we'll get into Apollo, a little I know today, but this was a transaction I did when I was long ago in my past.
Very, very nice place. I used to go there when my brother used to live, and I highly recommend for people to visit. You have very nice trees, which actually we don't have when we go skiing in South America.
Absolutely.
So as an introduction, let me share with the audience a short version of your extensive bio for context and their benefit, especially if they haven't met you before. Craig Goggett is the charismatic founder of Pegasus Capital, which he started 25 years ago to focus on sustainability and health. A real pioneer in the impact space without ever having claimed to be so. Craig is also quite an investment legend and was one of the original co-founders of Apollo. Craig is the founder and co-managing partner of Pegasus Capital Advisors and co-founder of Pegasus Sustainable Century MBLP since 1995. He has executed over 70 transactions at Pegasus and has assembled a world-class team of investment, operational, and policy professionals. He has led Pegasus to focus on businesses that secure competitive advantage through resource conservation, efficiency, and security. Pegasus Sustainable Century brings capital and expertise to businesses that can compete successfully on the basis of resource efficiency and sustainability. Craig has over 30 years of private equity investing, complex financial restructuring, and legal advisory experience. From 90 to 1995, he was a senior principal and a founding partner of Apollo Advisors LP, involved in virtually all aspects of Apollo's largest investments. From 1984 to 1990, he was an advisor principally to Drexel, Burnham and Lambert Incorporated and associated entities. In 2008, he was elected to receive the New York League of Conservation Voters Corporate Pioneer Award. And Craig is a graduate of Harvard Law School and Brown University. Anything I should add, Craig?
Well, the only thing I might just add, which I'm very proud of, is my wife and I, together with a wonderful young man in Nazareth, founded an organization called Polyphony, which is devoted to bringing young Israeli Arabs and Jewish Israelis together through classical music. Really, it's a civil society experiment and building program through the arts. And we're very proud. And it grew out of what is Israel's largest Israeli-Palestinian community in Nazareth. So that's something I'm proud to have founded with my wife and this wonderful fellow, Nabil Abu Dashkar.
Very nice. Is this connected historically to your family, or is there any relation?
Just, I love classical music, and I've been involved with human rights and the like. And it's actually through Brown University, something I was also involved with. There's a Humanities Center, and through the Humanities Center director at Brown, I met Nabil, and the rest was history. It was really launching the venture. So like a number of things I do, we launch it, and then it takes a life of its own. And this is what I'm just very, very proud of for my family.
Right, right. Thank you. I mean, we were talking about it before. You had so many roles, and you have been helping so many different kind of universities at an advisory board or trustee level, and always busy trying to do some extra curricular activities on top of everything that you do as a businessman, right?
Yes. Well, and one of the things I'll just mention, I really enjoy, which you don't put in a CV because there's nothing quite to say, but one of the things I've really found over the past few years, particularly in this impact space, is mentoring. I'm working with a number of young CEOs who are really fabulous, and they've got some great ideas. So that's sort of something I do informally. And that's an increasing part of my time in this area.
We may come back to that, but very quickly, is this related to some organization specifically, or just people reaching out to you?
Just people reaching out with ideas, and often they're not right for investment. But for us, it's either for Pegasus or for some of the firms we're involved with. But I just enjoy, people have a passion and excitement. It's just something I'm increasingly finding. If I can help them, mentor them, lend them my experience, some of my Rolodex, it's something I'm doing a lot these days.
That's very nice. Very kind of you. Very important. I'm a big advocate, of mentoring. I believe that it's important in terms of mentoring and being a mentee as well.
Energy. You get energy from them. And I learn. And it gives me new thoughts. And, it is giving back, but it is absolutely receiving. I'm really enjoying that. And that's really been much more over the past 3-4 years. So I don't know what you other than mentoring, it's not through an organization. I mean, sometimes there are organizations I'm involved which will do that, but it's really much more informal.
And I've been doing it for quite some time, and I find it fascinating because as well as inspiring or helping others, we get inspired. And also it's interesting to see sometimes how the mentee overtakes us.
You hope that, just like with your children. I have 4 sons. My wish is they always overtake me. So the same thing if you're mentoring somebody, and they will. And, if we're talking about things like sustainability, I think they see the world differently than we do. When you and I talked about this at one point, we grew up in a world of plenty. I mean, especially in the United States, we never understood that we might not have these things. But today, even in America now, they understand that we're threatened. Certain things we've taken for granted may not be. So given that perspective, and now add COVID. So I think that they come with a perspective of questioning and how are we going to deal with this, which in many ways, my generation and following generations didn't have. So I think there's lots of insights they can bring.
So I know that we have had a couple of conversations that people may realize have been some really great conversations. And the one thing about younger generations is always that they look at things from different perspectives and different approaches to risk and risk management. And it's very different from somebody that has been in the industry and in a risk-adjusted industry for 20 or 30 years, right?
Yes. And I think there's a different view of what risk is, too, that they might have a broader concept of what are risks, obviously, that you have to adjust for.
So in this new definition of risk, maybe it's very timely to ask you the first question that we always ask our guests, which is, what is sustainable and impact investing?
Well, in one sense, and I prefer sustainable investing, even though I know some people don't like it, and there's a lot of talk about ESG, and ESG is obviously a very important component. But sustainable investing for me, apart from the narrow environmental sense, is really in investing where you are contributing to making the world at the end of the day in any number of categories a better place, as well as making money, because it is investing. You can do sustainable nonprofit investing, but if it's for profit, in addition to ideally it's sustainable because you can't keep getting investors because you'll make money, but you are contributing either to the environment, to health, to society in terms of helping the disadvantaged. There are other benefits besides simply profit making. And I think that's impact. And impact can take a variety of forms. I mean, narrowly in my business, our focuses are health and wellness, and particularly on climate change investments, more narrow environmental sustainability. But when I think of sustainable investing, I do think about it more broadly.
Yes, and I'm with you on that. And then investing, looking into impact, and the point I find it quite interesting. So I was at an event on Saturday and speaking to a very successful businessman. And when I mentioned the word sustainable investing, he immediately assumed that it's non-profit making. So it is fascinating to see that people still don't understand that profitability now depends on the sustainability of business models.
Yeah, and especially as we think about climate, businesses, governmental organizations, militaries have all realized, I mean, they have to take into account climate change. Climate can destroy a business's supply chain. It can destroy consumer preferences. There are so many aspects of how you have to factor in sustainability into your very future. And I think often a disconnect between the most forward-thinking corporations and folks like the people you said. I think corporations who understand this, food companies who are sourcing from all over the world, they understand sustainability. I mean, they may not always live 100% of it, but they understand they have existential threats if they don't deal with things correctly.
And all that said, you know, the second question on this part goes back to the name of this series, you know, which is Sustainable Investment Dilemma. And the question is, are we facing a sustainable investment dilemma or an investment dilemma as well, for that matter, right? Do you have any views on that?
Well, I think there's so many areas. In certain cases, we need to be more creative. And certain cases, we'll talk maybe a little later today about something we're involved in with blended finance. Certain things, if you look at, for example, at solar in the United States and Europe, at one point, we needed lots of tax credits and other things to happen, and pricing was very high. But now it's largely becoming a commodity. As people have accepted it, and there's demand for it among folks like Google, Apple, et cetera, to buy it, and cities with policies. So in many areas of the world, we need to be more creative to attract, getting back to this point, for profit investing. We need to de-risk it. In some cases, we will need development finance institutions to do it. People who have foundations will do things. So given the scope of the challenges we face, I think the burden for the financial community working together with some of these institutions is to be creative, because we have to address, again, focusing on climate change, we don't have time. So I think the dilemma is not one size fits all, whether geography or sector, and the types of projects. So I think, just as you mentioned with the person saying, oh, you can never make money, in some cases, you may not be able to at first. So how do we not think narrowly, but think more expansively and use all the financial creativity we have? Financial folks are great at coming up with things, you know, like collateralized obligations, derivatives. How do we apply various financial tools to fit different models and different needs? So I think there is a real dilemma, because there are so many different areas that investments needed. And long term, there's so much opportunity as I look around the world. But again, simple structures won't necessarily apply to investing in a developed country versus an emerging market, in a national program versus a regional program. And again, depending on how much new technology, there's some amazing technologies which need to be applied. But often the timing to deploy them and make sure they work can be very long. So you may need different types of capital for those sorts of investments.
Yes. And again, I use the word advocate. I like that. But you know, with this that we do in terms of, you know, trying to share the knowledge and educate people, that one thing that you said, there's no one fits all. That is something that really, really resonates. And I try to tell everyone, I'm trying to explain to people what this means, right? in case people haven't heard me publicly speaking or in previous episodes, you know, I always like, there are so many examples, right? And I would like to come back maybe to water, which is one, I think, that we talked about, and waste, right? That you have maybe more knowledge. But I always think about this when I realized finding the solutions versus managing where we are today. And the example is coal. So, you know, we're talking about carbon capture and all these new world ideas that are real, that are happening. People are trying.
They are real.
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to deploy, and they're, you know, fundraising to some really good companies in Switzerland, US. And then you have people kind of see the whole. I always mention the word supply chain because it's easier to understand, but it's, you know, in terms of investments and solutions, it's not a supply chain, it's just alternatives. And the fact that, you know, in some countries we kind of really stop coal like straight away, and therefore banks and financial institutions that are funding those plans still have a time until we transition. And I repeat this, I mentioned this in a couple of episodes before, but I think you can never repeat it enough so that people understand that we need that transition finance, you know, transition period to find the solutions and to find the structures, to find the, in the financial services side, you know, the different instruments. And, you know, some people argue that we don't need any new instruments. Well, that's another conversation. And then, you know, understand that we will need that timeline to be able to change.
Well, one of the things I know we talked about as well in some of our conversations is transitional fuels. I mean, sometimes we need to be able to transition, sometimes for resilience, but also I'm personally a believer that when done right, using things like natural gas, I'm involved with a project in Nigeria where we're taking flared natural gas, which is both a health and a carbon nightmare, and converting it to CNG or LNG and converting diesel users to CNG LNG with a view ultimately to getting them into solar or wind. But those sorts of transitions in the real world are necessary. So I think we may need financial instruments, but we may need solutions as well that are not 100% carbon pure. And I think that's, again, just we're not going in many cases to be able to totally switch off. And that's often from a health perspective as well. I mean, again, flared gas is a great example. And the use of diesel is something which is not only bad for the planet, it's bad for human health. Those are really bad to breathe for the communities they're near. And so if we can put them on a healthier emitter still, it's a benefit as well as a carbon benefit.
Yes. And then I was going to mention the challenge that we have with water. By no means, I'm no expert, but, you know, it caught my attention. I was watching this documentary on the weekend, which is quite new, around the water market. This is interesting because although this is what we live, I don't think people realize that actually water is not free anymore.
A lot of them still expect it to be, yes. And that's a problem. And in many countries, water is effectively free still, even if their governments are paying for it. I mean, in most parts of the world still, water is considered a right. And I mean, governments, depending on where you are, governments have been pricing it differently. But in most places, whether it's free or paying, you're still not paying what it costs. If I'm in New York City or I'm in Connecticut where I live, my water bill does not reflect the real cost of that water. And people are experimenting. So one of the real challenges, and we've looked a lot at water investments here, actually, you know, in Colorado as an example, I mean, you need water to make snow in most ski resorts, and there's a cost to that. But I think as much as we've seen with carbon, the ideas of carbon credits or carbon taxes, I mean, water, which is such a vital commodity, obviously we can't live without water. Ultimately, I think there will be many more sophisticated pricing mechanisms. There's some incredible technologies now. I mean, there are two huge areas I think with, again, water needs to be focused on. One is in our cities, there are, and some amazing technologies can help, but we lose so much water to old pipes, old transmission distribution systems. And the water waste that goes on is astounding, and the cost. Now, and there's some, again, there's some wonderful companies. We've looked at a bunch of them, almost did a transaction with an amazing one where they can detect and help fix it and monitor it. But that's going to be an amazing area. And again, the question is, how do you price that for the companies who can solve the problem? But we lose in our major decaying infrastructure cities so much water. The second area really to focus on is more emerging market, where often there is no distribution. There is no effective way to get water to people, that healthy, clean water. And whether that results in nutrition problems, disease, the opportunity using technology to, without building complicated distribution systems, to deliver water to rural areas, whether in the United States with Native American populations, whether in Africa, I think is a huge opportunity. And then when you add to the fact that you can probably do it with less power, using solar and other things, I think we're going to see a whole new set of infrastructure solutions on a distributed basis.
Yes, and you kind of read my mind, because I always talk about infrastructure, you know, I'm making people understand one of the biggest challenges on water that we have in even in developed countries, in developed cities, let alone in third world countries, is the problem with infrastructure. And you mentioned, you know, the pipes and what happens, which is the waste that we have, right? And then the quality, which is something else in terms of, you know, the water quality that is being challenged. And I think from what I have studied so far, one of the best examples I've learned about is just the way that they're doing it. I think it's in France and in Paris, yes. You know, that they have like the top quality and processes, etc.
And it's so vital to our health. Obviously, in the United States, we saw a problem with Flint, Michigan, which was a disgrace. But that's an extreme example. But given how vital water is, I think there will be renewed attention focused on it.
And it's very interesting because the two things that we talked about are carbon and water. So we need oxygen, right? And we need water. So that is like the two basics for humans to live, right? And again, we lose perspective. I think water is less on the conversation. You know, people obviously focus a lot on emissions, but it's something that is going to definitely come up. I will add the link on the notes for people to watch the documentary. And unfortunately, this documentary, and I haven't shared it with you, Craig, but I'll send it to you as well. It puts us on a really bad, again, financial services, right? Into a really, yeah, really bad light. And especially private equity, they really go after private equity, saying, you know, all the effectively, maybe they didn't use this word, but the greedy approach, because, you know, with privatization, and in this case in the UK with Margaret Thatcher, you know, there are cash cows. And they show a little bit of the story of how it happened in terms of, you know, people's rights and the way that we used to charge, you know, when it first happened and how it's changed and improved. And then they also show the impact that it has on farms. And they use Australia as a great example because it's the driest place on earth and they have some of the driest cities in the world. And basically farmers cannot survive anymore because, you know, it's just too expensive to buy the water, you know, $500,000 of cost just to give water to the cattle, right? So
water is a crisis. And these are all interrelated when you think about it. I mean, it's one of the things I've learned with sustainable investing. I mean, it's another definition of sustainability. What's the unintended consequence of doing one thing with another resource? You can end up doing something which may be good carbon-wise, but if it's negative water-wise, if it's negative human health-wise, what have you accomplished? So I think it's one of the things we try to do is focus on an ecosystem of investing. And water, in terms of energy use, is huge in terms of transportation. So again, if you look at things like desal, for example, which we need in certain places, and there are complicated environmental issues, the energy cost can absolutely be huge. And so the question is, again, are you using emitting energy to do, I mean, bad energy creation, or are you using solar? So all these things I think you have to look at. And water will increasingly, certain industries in terms of food production, gobble up water. We think about ice cream production, which I love ice cream, but certain ways we make it, there's just so much water waste and it's a precious commodity. So I think it's not at front and center of people's minds, but if you're in certain countries or certain areas, like the farmers in Australia, like the area where everyone's talking about basically in Africa in terms of the Great Green Wall, I mean, water is crucial. I mean, those areas used to have trees, it's been devastated. And it's a combination of climate change, but also uses of water and misuses of water. So I think you're very right to highlight that as an important area.
And again, this was completely unplanned, but it's, you know, fascinating because it made another point, which is this interrelation, which most of us have been completely ignorant and completely unaware of. And also another thing I've learned, which I don't mention that often, and I'm not that much of an expert either, but the use of water in fashion. I've seen, you know, the effects in some of the lakes, you know, in some of the countries where they're most produced, where we buy most of the production of fast fashion, and you see how they have consumed whole lakes and whole, you know, resources, which I didn't realize as well that they are one of the biggest consumers of water in terms of industries, which again, it blew my mind to be technical.
Well, but that's why I think it's so important in the sustainability discussion. Climate change is so existential, as I said earlier, but we have to remember there are other existential threats, and we can't only focus on one issue because they are related. I think one of the areas, and I may be jumping ahead a bit, that we talked about is we're going to start seeing, I think, people do certifications, standards are going to come in. And I really do think we're going to see people not be able to do an ESG scorecard where they don't deal with water. I mean, you can't talk about carbon and not cover other areas, not talk about how you treat your workforce. You can't talk about not how you don't treat the community. I mean, plenty of people are very good at picking and choosing, but the scorecard has to be much broader. And I think that's going to be a growing trend on the corporate level, the financial level, and in general in the ESG and sustainability area.
Yeah, yeah. And so let's come back, you know, also because I know that some of the solutions that you are creating on this, but I thought it was, you know, very much worth to mention because, again, people have to realize, I think, the audience and also the industry, our industry, to understand how we manage this, you know, from now and included of all the other things that we are looking at. So let me move to talking a little bit about Pegasus, as I like calling it, because of the Spanish, but it's Pegasus, your company.
I prefer Pegasus.
Yeah.
I like your pronunciation better. No,
and I was thinking we can go from Pegasus today to tomorrow, kind of what you're doing. And then I would love to just go back a little bit into history after, rather than the other way around, so reverse timeline. So I wanted to ask you, so what is it that you're doing today and what are you focusing on Pegasus?
So right now at Pegasus, JP, we're focused on two broad areas, sustainability and health and wellness, and often the intersection of where they're at, which again reflects the connectivity we talked about. I mean, often what we do environmentally, obviously, is an impact, but it's not only in planet health, but human health. And we do that in a number of ways. One of the areas that we're very focused on right now is working with the Green Climate Fund to launch our first product, and then we have several others coming to bring creative solutions in this area of blended finance to the emerging markets. I think we may be the largest private fund accredited by the UN Green Climate Fund in North America. And we've launched something called the Subnational Climate Fund, which I've had a long history in thinking about subnational finance. It's a blended finance vehicle, which we can talk about, all of the creative structures. And we're very excited about that because it's dealing with a lot of the challenges you alluded to earlier. So that's among lots of things going on, some earlier things, but of particular import to us now is this vehicle we've launched.
Yes, yes. And to maybe for the benefit of people, I like how you describe some of the parts of Pegasus as well. And I recommend people to go to your website, which is pcalp.com or pcalp.com. And as you mentioned, you know, you're investing in sustainability and wellness. We'll come back to the wellness part as well, which we very much enjoyed previous conversations. But you are a private alternative asset management firm providing a strategic growth capital to middle market companies, focused on these two sectors. And I like the, how you mentioned, you recognize these different factors, right? So that population growth, we've been talking fluctuating energy and commodity prices, you know, which
yes.
relates to the points that we were talking just before, you know, with water as, you know, one of the, you know, scarce commodities that is going to be quite a factor. And this recognition, as you have mentioned many times to me, that, you know, resources are not unlimited, which we were referring to some of the youngsters realizing that maybe better than we did. But then you're also looking at some of the kind of the legislative agenda driven by the demand of the constituent. You being a lawyer can very much appreciate how you look at things, you know, very differently perhaps, you know, than the other deal makers. And it says here, and you're looking at this new consumer buying equation, bringing sustainability to the forefront. So, you know, how behavior is changing, creating what you call the most exciting investment climate of our age.
I think that, and it relates to, again, that the new consumer, that younger generation. I spoke actually the other day, I think I was mentioning it to you at a summit for young hoteliers sponsored by a very famous hotel school in Switzerland. And my subject was this. And the consumers are different. Every brand, consumer brand out there, has to take into account that the younger consumer, this active in media, social media, they care. They may care sometimes about things that are not as important as others, because good marketing can do some pretty basic things. But whether it's something like the Tom Shoes, a Bombas socks, which has grown in America, which are really focused on social good, or something like an Allbirds, which is, as a consumer brand, is all focused on sustainability. I think consumers will need to know more, and corporations have to take that into account. Supply chain is going to become, I think, increasingly, it's an area we're very focused on, the supply chain. We've talked some, and one of the areas which brings health and wellness and sustainability together is agriculture and food production. But supply chain and transparency is going to be increasingly important to consumers. All of what you talk about in the fashion industry too. They're going to want to know where things come from and was it sourced sustainably.
Yes. And if I go, again, just for the benefit of people, in terms of the firm, you have, if I remember correctly, you have five funds. Now the sixth one is the SCF, right?
Yeah, and the sixth one is the Subnational Climate Finance Fund. We've had five private equity funds, more focused in the United States, Canada, and Europe. The sixth fund is focused on the emerging markets in this blended finance vehicle.
Perfect. And just for the benefit of any investors listening, is it still open?
Yes, we've really just begun marketing it, yes. And the way that investment works is the way I say blended finance, which gets to your earlier comments about flexible financial structures. This vehicle, the UN Green Climate Fund, has committed junior capital to support both returns and basically provide risk protection. And so it's a $750 to $900 million fund, of which 20% of the capital is coming from the Green Climate Fund on a junior basis.
Yes. And I like as well how you define it on the presentation, which is, you know, it's a high profile infrastructure investment initiative for emerging markets. And then the point about the Green Climate Fund, you know, for those that do not know, is a development finance institution for the UN for everything climate. And they had committed $150 million as first lost investment to the fund.
Yes.
Which, again, this is all public information. And we will add the link to the notes as well, but it's greenclimate.fund/project/FP152 if people want to go and find it. And we'll talk about as well how you managed to get this commitment, and also there is a certification behind this. But let me come back to that, because I think that it's worth noting so that people understand how much work it takes and what it takes to receive such a commitment from the Green Climate Fund. And then I was going to mention, so in terms of what you're trying to as climate and infrastructure, would you like to share a little bit more about what is the SCF strategy?
Sure. So this goes back, and by the way, I should mention that, as I think you did, we're thrilled to launch this on our 25th anniversary at Pegasus. It's a big year for us, and to be able to do something that I think will have the impact this will globally, and capitalize on all the knowledge we've had in investing in this way over 25 years, I think it's really fitting. So a while ago, I was involved, and since, as you also alluded to, JP, we've been involved with policy, climate summits. Governor Schwarzenegger in California sponsored, together with Ban Ki-moon, a number of sort of focused on regional climate initiatives, where governors, mayors, provincial leaders could end up sponsoring climate, really at the climate initiatives at the grassroots level. Out of that grew the founding of an organization called the R20, which is based in Geneva, which I was one of the founding directors of. One of my colleagues you know well was also a founding director who's now joined us, which I'm thrilled about, Patrick Sherrill. And the focus really was to go into this area. There have been lots of studies, 50 to 75%, depending on the view, of what's needed on the climate agenda are at those levels, at the subnational level. They're smaller to mid-sized projects, harder to finance, often in sectors that are not as glamorous as renewables. So that is our focus here, to invest in mid-sized projects, the subnational level in the emerging markets through a regenerative agriculture, nature-based solutions, waste, water, we can do energy efficiency. We will do some renewable, but not exclusively. And that's really where the action, I think, in the climate world is. And to show you can do that profitably and replicate and scale. And our desire really is, as we, there are 42, soon to probably be 45 countries we can invest in, is to be able to do one project in one country or region, or a number of projects, and again, since it's regional, and then scale it by replicating it in other adjacent geographies, because that's the only, we don't have time. And when you do project by project without using a fund like this, the inefficiencies and the time it takes to just launch one project just don't allow us to move fast enough. So our goal is to really scale. And it grows out of this initiative, I said, back in 2009, our very first meeting, I think, in California.
It's interesting. And again, I will ask you some more specifics around the examples and some of the investments that you're looking at. You touched upon so many different concepts and terminologies here, right? I think it's there's some national level. I think specifically we didn't mention it. We mentioned it before, but you're investing in mid-sized, climate resilient and low carbon infrastructure and nature-based solutions, which is something that I want to really talk about. I think you mentioned before as well, concessional capital, which is, you know, another one of the components. And again, I know that for you, this soul, and for many people that listen, you know, that are quite technical, this is not every day for everyone, but, you know, it's well known. But I thought it's worth mentioning all of these key concepts, which I will also add to the notes for the benefit of people, so that, you know, people can learn what it actually means, right? Because it's almost layer upon layer. As you talk to me, I'm picturing everything in terms of the solutions, the companies, the structure you're putting in between all those companies and those solutions and the investors. You know, the fact that on the side, you know, you have the Green Climate Fund, you know, supporting across in a way. I like it.
And I might also mention, to do this, and we have a consortium. And again, this is systemic thinking, which is sort of a theme I may get a little boringly systemic about, systematic about. But we have partners. The R20, which I mentioned, is one of our partners to source and help evaluate deals and reach out to governments. IUCN, which is an amazing group of nature-based charities, an umbrella organization, also based in Switzerland, is a valued partner. They've pioneered nature-based solutions. They're part of our consortium. And part of this is we have what's called a technical assistance facility, which they manage, which allows us to go in and develop projects without charging investors effectively, which the Green Climate Fund and others are funding. So we can do more development work and ensure that projects can be brought to basically investability or bankability. And again, they have so much reach and so much knowledge. We have Gold Standard, which is, I've alluded to before, which is a certification. They're our conscience. They are not only certifying that we're meeting all our goals on an investment basis, but as a fund. And then BNP is obviously well known as a financial institution, but very committed to the climate space, is also part of our consortium. So I think to tackle these sorts of things, it may not always be typical in the financial community to work together, but that's one of the things I've learned sort of as a deal maker. I always try to bring people together. But I think one of the things we really need to do in this area is get people to cooperate, collaborate. And again, it's not typical in the financial community to do that. We tend to compete. Here, we got to work together.
Yes. But two points to make on that. One is that definitely you mentioned the systemic change, the collaboration. And personally, it happens to be because, you know, I have been talking to all the people like yourself that are doing this. And it happens to be that I know that everyone is collaborating at that level. Although still perhaps it's the, you know, a small percentage within, you know, the larger number of people involved. I don't have the numbers in terms of people, but obviously it's reflected on the level of investment, right? These 30 or 40 trillion into sustainable investing versus, you know, a 300 or 400 trillion market or assets, right? Investable assets. But definitely, I think that, and the other point about the systemic change and the example, the real example that we are sharing today with you, working with all of these organizations, I like, because, you know, people are not aware that it's happening. So, you know, people are still, a lot of people discontent with the speed of change, and because I am aware of what is happening in the background and some of the organizations, how they're working together. So I'm very happy that you are here with us today to share the example and share, you know, what I call I want to find a new terminology because somebody challenged me, or not challenged me, but I got inspired by somebody else about, I talk about best practices, but this is beyond best practices because it hasn't been done, right? So I need to find a new word, Craig, if you can help.
Well, JP, you'll find it, I think. You know, but what's interesting is I think it's not just us. I mean, it's like the NGOs, these wonderful for an IUCN to want to partner with the private sector. I think there's a recognition. And you're right. People, one of the nice things in this area of the impact investing is people do collaborate because I think we all have a common goal. And whether we're large, small, investing in one area or the other. So I think that that is one of the exciting areas. And we are creating a new type of best practice. You'll figure out what the term is. But I do think to accomplish what we need, and it gets, it's this holistic set of solutions, which by the way, nature-based solutions are about holistic solutions. It really is measuring how do we use biodiversity and use nature to help us solve a number of issues, whether they're food issues, whether they're carbon issues, they're water issues. I'd encourage, by the way, anyone among your viewers who wants some great your listeners, IUCN's website description of nature-based solutions and a number of the things they talk about are really marvelous.
Thank you for that. And as you mentioned, actually, I got inspired. You know, I tried to go outside my bubbles, you know, so that I get inspiration. And actually, I got that inspiration from a guy called Jay Abraham, which is a marketeer, American, very well known. He has made, you know, companies earn billions by just changing the messaging. That's what it sounds like, but it's a lot more. He was talking about mathematically, you know, there is something beyond exponential, and he has a new book. So that's why I started thinking, well, to be able to really find a solution and save the world, we need to think that way. We need to think on a completely new way, a new formula, because obviously the current system has taken us to where we are. And by doing the same, we're not just not going to be able to change fast enough the, you know, the movement of the tanker, right? So a couple more things that I want to keywords again that I wanted to bring up, you know, is kind of the connectivity, is a diversified fund, project based, which you mentioned. I had some notes from before. I can't remember if you mentioned this about the blind pool.
Yes, we haven't identified most of our projects in advance. And that's an advantage, I think. I mean, sometimes people have said, isn't it better to know what you're investing in? Well, the problem is if you just go project by project again, often the projects may not work. And then you've got raised capital, you've spent all your time fundraising. So I think a blind pool deployed responsibly, we can start on a project and conclude it doesn't make as much sense. There may be a better project. We'll have learned something where we can change what we're doing. And then this replication issue, where we can take a technology provider, partner with a company that's in the waste sector and do it in multiple geographies to scale. So we have an ability to go across sectors and different countries. Our investments, again, here are focused in Caribbean, South America, Central America, Africa, and various regions in Asia, North Africa, some Eastern Europe. So they're pretty diverse geographies. And again, the sectors are broad. But within that, you find municipal waste solutions, for example, the technologies that will work are not all that different.
Yes. And you mentioned actually in terms of sectors and regions. So is anything in particular you're going for first and then you have like a staggered deployment?
Well, we have an active pipeline already. One of the areas I did mention, which is very focused, particularly in the Caribbean and Central America, is resilient, sustainable agriculture. What's interesting about places in the Caribbean is they import food. And most of their food goes to tourists. They're best the crops that they grow. So there's and climate lends itself to food production. And those where the soil may not be quite as good, there are some very wonderful technologies to develop agriculture. So I think that's an area we're clearly focused on. We're focused as well in particularly distributed renewable energy in certain areas with indigenous peoples in certain parts of South America, Central America, Mexico, where again, they're off the grid, where power is needed for basic living and health. We're focused in Africa on a number of particularly waste projects in West Africa and Eastern Africa. Things we can do is so broad here. This is meant to be a first fund, and we're going to hopefully, this will be a continuing set of opportunities, which will take a lot of our time. We'll cover many of these other things we can't get to with this first fund, which again is our sixth fund, but our first one in this area.
Yes, yes. And in terms of target, what is the target of the size of the fund?
Fund size will be between $750 and $900 million.
Perfect. And you had a great presentation, but so if people want to kind of reach out and get hold of, you know, more information on specifically on the SEF, what is the best way?
To reach out to Brian Friedman at Pegasus, who can provide that. He's on our website, our general counsel.
Perfect.
And that we can put them in touch with our folks who are focused 100% of their time on this.
Perfect. Thank you. I know that we can, you know, talk just about this alone for quite some time. I think there's so much to discuss and about SEF and then also related subjects. But one last thing before we move to another question was, you have the certification that allows you to have the commitment from the Green Fund. So can you share a little bit about that?
It's a lot of work. So I mentioned my general counsel, others. You have to become an accredited entity, which means there are all sorts of filings you have to do, policies you have to enact, covering a broad range of subjects, obviously with commitment to climate being number one. But it's a hard process. And then you sign in after you basically the decision is made to accredit you. Then you have to go through an accreditation agreement. I think the process took us about 2.5 years. I think it's been streamlined more under the new GCF leadership, but it's a major commitment because it reflects you have to agree to various things as part of your policies. It's not just signing a sustainability declaration. It reflects that this is what you're really about. So not that many people have been able to get accreditation. Again, it's becoming somewhat easier and more streamlined, but I'm very happy we did that. Then after you become accredited, you can submit for projects to get funded, like SCF and like other things we're in the middle of talking about, which I hope to come back and talk to you about soon in the future too.
Yes, yes. So I want to come back to that point about the history, right? But let me pause there because I think when I ask you some of your personal history towards the end of the episode, and perhaps, you know, with SCF and some of the other funds that you had with Pegasus, I just wanted to understand some more about your clients, your people, you know, your team. You mentioned Patrick Scholder, by the way, episode 25 of the Impact Leaders podcast. If people want to meet him, he's an incredible person as well in terms of sustainable investing and as a leader, former CEO of Blue Orchard.
You talk about a legend. That's a legend. Patrick's a legend. And he and I had talked for a number of years about doing something together. Again, he was the co-founder of this organization, the R20, which is focused on subnational finance, climate finance. Originally, as we were more doing it, sort of consulting work and helping. But to be able to get Patrick to join, and Patrick's totally mission-driven. This is all about people in our business, you know that. And, you know, I've been lucky enough at Pegasus to find some CEOs who are mission-driven, passionate about their businesses and our team now. Because that's critical of this. This is hard. I mean, as we're talking today, you know, the types of things and the need to coordinate and the ecosystem you need to create. You need, number one, I think, and this is what my best colleagues at Pegasus, someone like Patrick, person we've recruited to be our portfolio manager for the Subnational Climate Fund, Simon Forsyth, they're incredibly intellectually curious as well as mission-driven.
You have quite a team, right? So how many people do you have?
Well, if depending on how you look at different areas, there are about 10-time full-time people in the different aspects. But then we have a large set of advisors with these different networks. So focused on this, it's about 10 people now, but lots of related entities we're working with.
Mm. And I'll come back to one specific question that I think is going to highlight some of these. And this is another first, by the way, I should have mentioned before, but it's kind of obvious. You know, I don't think we have had anyone from the private equity asset class in the podcast before. So it's another first. So we have two, Colorado, Craig, private equity, which brings me to this question, which I asked you another time. As a private equity expert, what makes, it's all about people, you said, right? But, you know, private equity deals and approach to investing is a completely different ball game. which most people, it is a very few, a small number of people that actually are part of it. And all of this group that you have worked with, and Patrick, also I mentioned to you, highlighted what a pleasure it is to work with you and with your team because of the approach and how you're doing business. So with that intro, I remember I asked you one time, so what makes a deal successful? Because then how do you apply that to sustainability, which, you know, is something that I think is very valid insight that I think everyone would like to package and sell if they could.
Well, obviously, when I started at Apollo, we were at a unique market time where we could make money by buying correctly. So there are times you can buy correctly, and as long as you're investing in a business that is strong enough to survive, you'll do well. But those are time sensitive. I think in general, what I've seen, and particularly as money is more available and more efficient, what makes a deal successful is, number one, management, people. But number two, having a business that people care about, that has, particularly in this world of information now, I mean, that's changed for one. I mean, when I was at Apollo, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all this financial available information. We didn't have as efficient markets. There's so much information now. Having a company that can survive scrutiny, do well with consumers, but business people will care about, whether it's a B2B or a B2C business. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the key. And the way it ties to sustainability, I think, is sustainability, there's a lot of gimmicks out there. There are a lot of greenwashing going on. I don't think ultimately that's going to be sustainable in sustainability. Mm. We're seeing it in lots of businesses. Can you have something which will deliver what you're promising? Whether it's in the waste sector, whether it's in basically biodegradable plastics, plastic alternatives, using too much water, or you're diverting things from food supplies. So I think it's that management and with the systemic approach. Obviously, there are going to be market. One of the things I like about the Subnational Climate Fund is we're trying to actually find inefficient markets. I mean, there are not that many in the developed world. But I think in the sectors we're in, we actually can really do substantially well, do good, but make money because it's white space. So one of the nice things is if you can find white space as a private equity investor, that's great. I mean, again, at Apollo in the early days, there was huge distress. Most people were afraid of the collapse of the junk bond market. We took advantage of it. We weren't afraid of it. So one private equity investment is if you can get to a sector before other people are and it's inefficient, I mean, you have to have fundamentals, businesses people care about, good management, good financial structure, stability. But in a competitive marketplace, the way you distinguish yourself, I think, is by having also, this is another comment I'd make, long-term vision. We live in a very short-term vision society now. And again, technology is wonderful, but one of the problems, I think, is we tend to focus too much on what the daily stock market quotes are. And I've learned that you can't do that. If you're going to build a business, have it grow, you want to take advantage of the markets. But at the same time, you can't really basically worry about what daily performance is because you're going to make the wrong decisions. Mm-hmm. You have to look at a business as an investor and build for the long term.
Very valid points. And the one thought that I have sometimes is it's kind of that's what we see at the surface as well. You know, they focus on the short term, they focus on, you know, the results of the quarter on quarter. And we still haven't changed that from, let's say, an equities and markets perspective. And perhaps even, you know, from performance, you know, even if they are not public, right? But over time, you know, better than anyone, you know, the people that are doing the real deals and really seeing the trends, they are not worried about that.
No.
They're just really, you know, playing ahead of, you know, what is happening not only next year, but in this case, a little bit, you know, pointing out the obvious, you know, the SEF and what you're doing with Pegasus now is the next 30 years.
I think so. You know, it's interesting speaking about something that's not necessarily sustainable investing, but you look at someone like Blackstone and where they're heading and talking about they're going from more traditional investing to growth with a focus, the recent IPO that got a lot of attention, Bumble, where they made a bet people thought was sort of crazy. And it was a growth investment, but it was a set of fundamentals, again, focused on young people. There are trends, particularly in a world where people need to be connected and using technology. And it's obviously been an incredibly successful investment. And they weren't focused on the short term and what people said about them.
Mm.
Obviously, an investment Pegasus would do, it's not within our parameters of health and wellness or sustainability. But I think you have to look at the future. And just one general, it's much more competitive than when, as I said, there's a lot of capital. So I think going places ahead and focusing on something that is long-term and won't be a fad is really crucial investing-wise.
Mm. And I'll ask you about the future in a couple of questions, but you know, I do study and follow the great Dalio, right? And, you know, his principles and his study of history. And I hope that, by the way, we have Arnold one day on the podcast and maybe Ray Dalio as well. But I wonder sometimes if what we're living is so unique that although the fundamentals are applicable in many respects, the trends are just completely unknown. So working it out.
Try to keep up with them or try to guess them, yeah.
Mm. And that's what it is, right? From a sustainable perspective of, say, you know, again, I always talk about, you know, the grand world, the grand phase of saving the world, while still trying to find solutions for people to live, find funding, and make the whole ecosystem work, right? Yeah, fascinating. And then in another conversation, I was just going to pinpoint a couple more things. And it's interesting now that I ask you the same question, but we talked on another conversation about this, about what makes a deal successful, right? And you made me realize that kind of the timely, the long-term vision, these fundamentals is a basic in terms of, you know, where you're going to go next and where you're going to actually make a difference in terms of making an impact and making a profit. Because then we go back to these other kind of fundamentals of private equity, which were like financials versus operational, the fundamental value, which you mentioned in terms of, you know, how leveraged the business is. Many of these things that you're going to invest in, is they're all, like you said, they're brand new, right? So it's a completely different ballgame. And this, you know, the other point that I think you mentioned another call was a strategic power, which again, for established businesses that you're coming as a private equity and trying to restructure it is one thing. But for not developing and funding these new solutions is a completely different approach, right?
It is completely different. And, you know, it will be interesting to watch. And it's very much, again, on the forefront, in part, I think, based on where companies were anyway, in part probably based on the, in the United States, at least on the recent presidential election. But, you know, what does ESG mean? So this is a hot topic. We could spend a whole day on that. But as it's being, again, interpreted differently, but I think ESG is going to get dramatically defined where it will be part of effectively a metric. But again, that's sort of white space. I mean, are we talking about investing in an oil company that's more sustainable than another oil company? Are we talking about an oil company which is doing 10% renewables? How do we think about that? What about if you're doing renewable or you're a renewable power company and you go into a community and you don't care about that community? How do we measure that? So I think all these things, and my unintended consequences, what are you doing with water? What are you doing to the food systems? I think those sorts of questions as to how we think about measuring performance, it's open and it's yet to be defined. But I think we know at least it's not going to be as simple as it was 10 years ago, which I think is a great thing. Obviously, that's where investing. So we're early stages in where that is, how we're going to measure performance.
Mm. Okay. And again, let's come back to that. But I was going to ask you, you know, on this kind of the deployment and what you're doing, maybe this is the time to talk about kind of the nature-based solutions that you mentioned. Anything that you can share with us to enlighten the audience and to learn more about what it is, why it's important, what difference will it make?
I think nature is, we were talking a little about religion before, interestingly. Universe has a way of doing things and healing itself. And nature-based solutions are really, let's do things in harmony with nature to clean up the soil, to clean up the environment. Let's not use chemicals. Great example of nature-based solutions are kelp, seaweed. What's there? It's so beneficial. How do we, as an economic matter, use things that nature gives us today that can replace fossil fuels in various products, can provide nutrition, can have carbon benefit, cannot deplete our water supplies? I think using what The sea gives us an example. It's a great example of a nature-based solution in an area we happen to be pretty fascinated with, as I think we've talked some. I mean, there are various plants in regenerative agriculture, and I'd encourage people to look at the IUCN website, and I can refer folks to other things, where we can plant crops that are in harmony with nature, have all sorts of benefits in terms of not needing chemicals, in terms of actually helping with carbon sequestration, building back the water table, and at the same time providing human health through very nutritious crops. So that's a good deal of what we're trying to do. One of the things we've also learned is biodiversity is not just a wonderful thing. I love nature. I love hiking. I love snowshoeing. I love going on safari. But biodiversity is key ultimately to planetary health and this healing that we need to do with our, with basically the planet in terms of water, carbon, et cetera. So that's really where nature-based solutions is going. Let's figure out what are the right tools that exist within the arsenal that nature's provided us.
Thank you for that. And I don't think I have ever mentioned this before, but it's interesting. And I know that from an investment perspective is very specific, and effectively what I hear is we haven't even tapped on the tip of the iceberg of the many solutions we can find to, again, transition from packaging, from consumption products. We were talking on another call about nutrition and how we can get the best nutrition by taking from certain extras that we are not using. But then one thing, as you mentioned, biodiversity, that I don't think I ever mentioned, on the new generation, there is an actor called Zac Efron. I don't know if you know of him.
Yes, I know. Yes.
But he did a documentary, you know, he went around the world, I think he paid for himself with the nutritionist, and they went through different countries showing what the developments are and what's happening with sustainability. And that's how I learned about Paris, actually, the water in Paris. But then he showed the example, I think it was in Costa Rica, how the government has invested in replanting trees and regenerating whole areas. It was incredible. Within 5 years, they have gone from zero to one. So the power of nature, you know, to heal, obviously.
And even so, I've seen that in parts of Africa where trees have been planted that suit the region. And I've seen where climate zones have been recreated. In one project I was involved with, where trees were planted, people said they hadn't seen a tree in 50 years. And what happened is once the trees were planted, all of a sudden rain came. All of a sudden humidity came. And these were trees that suited the region. And the whole new, basically mini environmental zones were created. So lots of benefits. So the Costa Rican example is a great one. So regenerative agriculture, it's easy to talk, and it's solar plants, you know, big wind farms, offshore wind. Very exciting announcement out of the Biden administration yesterday about developing the U.S. offshore wind. And that's really wonderful. But in climate globally, to me, regenerative agriculture, nature-based solutions, waste, as you talk about packaging, we waste so much stuff. And as we talk about, we don't have plenty, we can't afford to waste things. And particularly things that, if you look at their chemical composition, they can be used for lots of things. Mm-hmm. So whether it's to turn agricultural waste into food, whether it's to turn agricultural waste into packaging, whether it's to turn municipal waste into packaging or fuel, that's, I think, one of the great opportunities as well as challenges we face. And that's a lot less glamorous than building, you know, a beautiful solar array. I mean, but I think that's where the message with the SCF, as I was talking about. But in general, I think that's where the action's going to be in the climate world.
Mm-hmm. And one last question before we move. You did mention to me about Ireland and coastal countries before as well. As some specific solutions that we look into?
You know, islands, both from, you know, in the climate world, we talk about mitigation and adaptation. Mitigations to lessen carbon impact and try to limit it. But adaptation deals with resiliency and dealing with the fact that we live in a world that is going to be climate challenged going forward. Islands are by their nature now. Island nations have to deal with the reality of climate disasters. Mm. even if we meet our most ambitious climate goals, and I don't think they're ambitious enough. Mm. So our investment there in terms, it tends to be focused as much on resiliency and adaptation. But I think whether it's in terms of, again, taking advantage of the sea, developing infrastructure that can survive climate disasters, and particularly in these areas, again, to minimize things by developing sustainable agriculture, regenerative agriculture, for the populations to have basically, from a food security standpoint, their own products, their own nutritious crops. I mean, too often what's happening, again, in these island nations is what they're importing is not only expensive, but not particularly nutritious. So I think from a human health standpoint, there's also a tremendous opportunity. And we're working with some wonderful people in that area, in the region, a number of really great companies.
Nice. Thank you for that. And obviously, again, you know, it just creates such an interest, you know, so people, please do reach out if this is of your interest, especially on the investment side. You just mentioned it before about identifying and measuring impact, right? And you know, there is ESG there, there is greenwashing, there is SPACs now. I don't know if you, is this anything, there's a personal side in terms of human behavior, which again, I love to, you know, to touch upon, but anything in particular that you want to highlight in terms of the way that you are looking to identify and measure impact? And then perhaps we can talk about the challenges, you know, with particularly greenwashing and ESG and SPACs.
Well, I think we're very focused on, we've done sustainability reports and ESG reports before it was common in the private equity industry, but we're trying to push it, particularly working again with this SNCF project, the Subnational Climate Project, to the next level with Gold Standard. It's multifaceted. We look at all the SDGs, but obviously our main focus is on this carbon, but all these unintended consequences. And looking across the ecosystem, how are we impacting? To me, there are multiple indicia. So we have a dedicated partner in that, and we're pushing the envelope. I mean, it's in progress. Mm. We're basically, I don't think a fund like us has been certified as a fund to meet on the whole meeting goals. So I think that's going to be a new standard, I hope. Mm. So to me, the biggest issue is you can't just pick one measure. As I've said, look as comprehensively as you can at what you're doing. And it's obviously a problem sometimes because how far back, if you're, there's some wonderful companies, CPG side and the retailer side, who are looking into their supply chain. How far back can you really go? But with things like human rights and the like, but we're really focused on trying to go as far into the supply chain as we can and be as transparent as we can in measuring. Mm.
Good point that this raises, and I can relate in terms of the vision and the proposition I created with my firm, with Island Partners, right? So where we propose to create the framework, the responsible investment framework, to measure everything that is in the different levels of the fund, the company, the fund, and the portfolio. And it's good to hear that effectively you still haven't all everything worked out and you still have the support, because people understand that we need to build this because it's new. And going back to the point in another question was that everything that we're doing is completely new.
We're evolving.
Yeah, and obviously it helps because you have all the track record as always, and you know you have done business and investment for a long time. But there's part of it that we just don't have the answer just yet, and that's what we need to build. So I didn't know that. I didn't understand that before we spoke. So, and that's again another good example for other people that are trying to replicate and do, you know, transition more capital into sustainable impact investing. Greenwashing then, SPACs, any other challenges or views?
Well, I just think, again, we're living at a time where there are a lot of very authentic people. There are a lot of people who they see ESG and climate change as a hot topic. And there are, again, wonderful people doing things in the area. And there are a lot of people who have not had a long-term commitment. I think it's great that people are getting into sustainable investing and ESG, but you know, you need to believe in it. It's not a fad. It's not a gimmick. And as in all areas, when something becomes hot and people see they can raise money, they can do things that may not be for the long term. I think for investors, I'd say just in general, for me, you don't want people who are doing it for the right reason, who believe it, who have the knowledge, to be discredited by folks who are just quickly jumping on the bandwagon. Now, it's good that there's a bandwagon. People see this as a value area. I mean, it reflects the fact that there's investor demand, whether it's, you know, in public stocks, whether it's in funds, whether it's in projects. So, greenwashing is a good problem to have in that it says people are seeing the sectors are attractive. But I think we need to be careful, again, to from short-term solutions, from gimmicks, or for things that really aren't accomplishing anything. You know, I can call anything an ESG investment. I mean, it's really easy. I'll tell you one or two things you need to do and it will look like it's an ESG investment. But you got to go beyond the superficial level. There's so many exciting investments that can be made in so many areas, as we've talked about, things like packaging, new delivery systems, logistics, wonderful areas. I mean, with ESG, we have the whole health and wellness area lends itself to being taught. The impact is huge. But I just think there'll be mistakes made. People will learn. And out of that, hopefully, we'll have more capital permanently flowing into really wonderful ESG or climate investments.
I was going to mention, and I'm going to raise this point that I share with you in the past, which is the integrity piece, right? So my middle age realization of the value and the meaning of integrity, as embarrassed as I feel sometimes to admit it, that I truly understand now what it means. The fact that you do things even when nobody's watching, although God may be watching, but you know, most of these people that are not integral don't believe in anything. But that's the challenge, I think, you know, with all of these, anyone that hears, most of the people that are listening to the podcast and to our conversation, I'm sure that are people that are trying, that are the closest to integrity that there is. But if, you know, if you're still thinking about it, you know, I do challenge people that when they're making decisions, you know, at the CIO level, at the, you know, founding partner or managing partner level or CEO level of investment management firm, you know, is this point about integrity, about, you know, what is it that you're showing, you know, to the market versus, you know, what is it that is really happening, you know, under the bonnet, right? Or behind closed doors.
Someone's watching. And if it's only you, if it's only, you know, literally, again, I'm guided a lot by legacy, future generations, like my four sons, someone's watching. But ultimately, you're right. We have to be the ones to watch ourselves.
Mm.
Yeah, it is something you learn. Integrity, and to me, a financial measure is investments where you take something public, let's say, and then it doesn't work and you've cashed out and, you know, you celebrate, but the asset itself is not fundamentally a good asset. That's not a success.
Mm.
I mean, if we sell a business, I want a business to be stronger. I want the person we sell it to make more money than we did. And we want to build, this is another obviously version of sustainability, build businesses for the long term, which will continue to be valuable and will be more valuable in somebody else's hands. Because otherwise, I mean, again, if you take something public, which happens a lot, and it goes down, you know, it goes out and 10 goes up to 100, you sell, then it's back at 5, you know, 5 years later, that's not a success. I mean, sometimes it just happens because things can go wrong with businesses or environment. But I think it's really important that we try to, I mean, I say this a lot, and it relates to the intellectual curiosity point. It relates to what sustainability means. Build for fundamental value. If you're doing that, and you really have that, and particularly, again, if you work with some great managers, like I've been fortunate enough to work with, I mean, that's what they're doing. They want to create fundamental value.
Mm.
And to do that, you have to have integrity. You have to know, this is what we're really doing. I mean, you know, if there's a problem, we better be dealing with it. And so I do think you can't hide things under the bonnet, as you say. Let's be transparent. And this is another theme, which we've talked about today a bunch, and I keep coming back to transparency, whether it's supply chain. Where did my article of clothing come from? If I'm going to the markets, let's be transparent about what we're doing. I think that's what we need.
And it's funny, I always said I remember the analogy, but I don't know if everyone will understand. You know, if you ever sold a used car to anyone, you know, in the past, you know, when you have like a blown engine and you still try to sell it, you know, par value, you know, and you just pass on, hoping that it's not going to blow while they're driving away. that doesn't really work, right? And finally, on this point, I do remember in one of our conversations, you mentioned that lesson or that phrase that you got from being at the grand jury about integrity and honesty. I have it here noted, but I can't remember if you remember better than me.
You know, I've been involved at various times in litigation. And in my time at Drexel, I've testified, and being able to be honest with yourself and honest with other people, and it's priceless. You have to sleep at night.
Yeah. So there is again something. There was something. There is no price you can pay for to have integrity and honesty. I think that's what I noted.
That sounds like I would have said that. Yes, I believe that. No price.
And obviously, we can talk about policies and regulation, but you know, I think that is maybe for another time. But I wanted to talk about the future, right? So, given all this we are talking about, we kind of touched upon some of the trends and some of the approaches that we need to look at in terms of thinking about the future and what's coming. But now, if we bring it to kind of existing funds and how we scale, you know, sustainable and impact investing, and perhaps more specifically to private equity, there are, I'm sure that you're more aware than most, the inflow to sustainable investing, but there is a real inflow to private equity impact investing with all the major firms, you know, launching impact funds in the billions, by the way, in case people haven't seen, you know, there are multi-billion pounds to start there with the Rise Fund, like one well-known. But if you look at, you know, as of last year and the year before already, I count at least 20 funds, you know, with multi-billions are in total having launched. So any comments on that? And especially any comments on the whole flow challenge, or is there a challenge? When I mean flow, I mean also deals, right? Not just the money.
So I think there's so much to do. So deal flow to me, in some ways, more capital will create more deal flow. So I don't worry about that. And as a competitor, I think it's great. The fact that the investors are asking major firms like TPG, like KKR, firms like that to do this is great. I think there's a market for folks like us and others who've been really focused on impact. Again, we've never said we're impact investors. We are. So yes, as you said to me, JP, we are an impact investor, but investing in areas that are by definition impactful. You know, I think focus is still important, and having special firms, whether they're investing in water, whether they're investing in forests, regenerative agriculture. One of the things I really hope that investors will do, and we're more generalist than some of those firms, is spread the investments to those folks too. Because again, the larger impact funds, they're doing wonderful things, but it's part of a bigger franchise. So they may not be investing in all the sectors that are most innovative or where money's needed. So I think it's a great trend that money's flowing, but I think this is such a vast opportune area. One of my hopes and things we need to watch out for is to make sure the flow spreads out. I think it's what we're trying to do with something like in the blended finance area, as we talked about. So I think there's a need for investors not to think, oh, their conscience is okay. We gave some money to TPG Rise, which is great that they're doing that, but that there are many other valuable targets for investment, which are not only needed, but can be very profitable.
Thank you. Just off the cuff here, if anyone is thinking of launching new funds, you know, and not from one of these world-renowned and famous private equity firms, but rather kind of a smaller one, any kind of quick advice that you can think of?
Have great people with you. Try to partner or meet. I mean, you need an edge. Have a great team. This may mean partnering with, you know, have someone who can be either an anchor investor or big sister or brother to help you. It's hard to do that. It just is so hard. And I wouldn't discourage it at all. I'd encourage it. But try to somehow build a competitive advantage, either, again, by getting an anchor investor, by having a partner in deal sourcing, by having a particular sector knowledge. That's what you need to do.
Thank you for that, Craig. So on that example, and on that note as well about, you know, telling people to do it, maybe is the time for you to tell us a little bit about you. And I know that we can talk, you know, for a long time. It's a great history, very rich history, which, you know, ideally we are going to do a very long, extra long episode one day. How did it happen that you ended up founding Apollo, you know, and how did it relate? Can you relate to this advice that you say to people about getting people together and to launch, you know, a firm for the first time?
Well, sometimes it's being in the right place at the right time. And sometimes it's building out of adversity. Apollo was created out of basically Drexel Burnham's collapse. And the firm came together with someone who wanted to, actually was a contrarian and believed that what other problems people saw in the bond market, you know, this use of junk bonds or high yield bonds, which is what we called it, was not as stressed as people thought. And there was it's a different sense of fundamental value. But out of that, the opportunity grew where someone believed, which is why I said, you need my advice. Have somebody, a big sister, big brother, who can help if you're starting yourself. We found an investor. We had knowledge other people had, but we had conviction that there was fundamental value. And we'd work together, which is always makes things easier. And there were really smart people. So that's really what led to Apollo. And it grew out of adversity. It grew out of a market collapse and the collapse of a firm we'd all work with. So, you know, in relating to it today, there are some real challenges, obviously, we're all facing, which we've talked about today. But I think those challenges demand creativity, passion, conviction. So if you find good people to work with, you're intellectually curious. And again, it helps to have some support built in because it's hard to do on your own. It's hard if you don't find an anchor. It's hard if you, and at Apollo we did, we found French investors who believed in what we were doing. So I think it can be someone in the financial community who will sponsor you. It can be, you know, corporate investor or corporate partner who will give you an advantage. And particularly, again, as we've talked about some of these specialist sorts of funds, I mean, and there's some people doing wonderful work in very discrete sectors and on the environmental side, like regenerative agriculture, like forestry, like the sea. Some folks are focused mainly in harvesting kelp and different ways to use things. So I think there are lots of ways to go, but that's one of the lessons I took away. It's hard. So you need as many advantages as you can, but if you believe in it, you have the right people around you, you're going to succeed.
Nice. That was, you know, quite a couple of years ago, right? A couple of decades.
Well, yeah. makes me rather ancient, but yes.
But is there anything sometimes that you reflect on and say, well, the typical, I wish I knew, or what would you have told your younger self, you know, when you were there just before or right at the beginning?
Well, I wish I would have known about the environment more. I wish I would have understood it. I didn't. I mean, at beginning, we started Pegasus and I began to do a bunch of it, but it wasn't 100%. We've been investing in sustainability since, you know, 96. But even then, I didn't know enough. So I wish I knew what I knew now, both in terms of opportunity and being able to think more about impact. At Apollo, we did great deals and we made money. I wish I could have started the impact career then. I didn't know about it. I've done a lot of deals. The ones that are most meaningful to me are the ones where we built things that are long-lasting and with, I think, great companies, great people, and where we've contributed positively. So I don't really have regrets about before, but you look back and say, what's been most rewarding to me as an individual? And I wish I would have known more, but that's what we learn in life. You know, in hindsight, I wish I would have understood climate change more seriously earlier.
And was there a pivotal moment or a person? Or I always say, like, maybe it was a book, maybe it was a person, you know?
It was, for me, gradual. Living in the West Coast of America as an East Coast kid, a New York City suburbanite, I had never really been to the West. And then I went out to law school. After law school there, became a lawyer. And then I worked at Drexel. And I began to experience nature in the American West. You know, I was the stereotype. I'd never been to a national park. I began to love wildlife. I began to love the ocean. And so that was a gradual dawning for me about the beauty of this planet and nature. And watching at the same time when I was living in Los Angeles, the first day I went to jog, I couldn't breathe. But seeing it get cleaned up and seeing how important air quality was, over time, the environment became very important to me. And then we'd already started doing some of this at Pegasus, but I met someone who was working still with us, Terry Tamminen, who was Arnold Schwarzenegger's EPA secretary, and is then essentially in a second term policy chief as well. And Terry is one of the leading authorities on climate change around the world, was chair and still is of the R20. And Terry really pushed me in this area. You know, I've been fortunate to have people, Gina McCarthy, who's now the climate czar, work with us for 2 years at Pegasus while she was at Harvard after leaving the Obama administration. So it's been a bunch of people, but probably other than my general sense of reading and the horror of what was happening to our oceans, the horror of what was happening to our wildlife habitats. But Terry really advanced my knowledge of climate change. So I'd say it's a combination of personal observation and personal passion, and then people, in particular Terry, but others that he introduced me to. But Terry sort of gave me a big kick in from behind and said, look, study. Terry's written books. I encourage people to read them. And since then, this other issue of intellectual curiosity, reading, I mean, I read a lot, and I encourage everyone who works with me to read a lot. And when you read, you get a little scared here. I mean, we're a lot scared. There's a lot of science and data as to where we are.
Yes.
And then the other key factor for me, which I'll keep coming back to, is four kids. I worry what planet they're going to be left with on so many levels. There's clearly the environmental, the health. I mean, we're going to have pandemics again and again. We need to be prepared for that scenario. Not for today, we can talk about. I mean, I'm crazed about our healthcare system and how we're going to deal with pandemics.
Oh, yes. Yes, we didn't even talk about that. Yes.
And that's going to be how we're going to make sure people can be fed. And there's so much. And at the same time where there are challenges, there's so much opportunity. And again, we'll talk later about healthcare. I mean, what we're learning about the microbiome, with genetics, there's obviously a revolution. But there's so many wonderful technologies and opportunities. So there's a little doom and gloom side that gets me to this place.
Mm.
But there's so much opportunity around it. And I think, and again, that's part of nature-based solutions, sitting in front of us, the opportunity. Mm. But very long-winded answer, I'm sorry. But it's personal interest, just looking at the world around me. And a big part of it was being in the West Coast and then traveling in America's West, which is just so inspiring and at the same time, terrifying to think what can happen to someone.
Nice. I'm 100%, 1000% with you. And we were just talking about my newest craze, which is, you know, swimming in the freezing lake. So I've been learning more and more to value and appreciate nature. I have always loved it, but a lot more in the last years, for sure. So I can completely relate to that. And then the point, we were talking about mentoring. I talk about this formula, which I came up with, which is, I talk about the 33, 33, 33, or the 33% and the average of 5, right? So we were talking about mentors and mentees, but then who you hang out with, right? This kind of, you know, you are the average of the 5 people you hang out with. I don't know if you heard that before.
Yes, yes.
You know, the importance of, you know, relating to good people that can kind of elevate you in some respects. And in my case, I'm not a very good reader, but I got the power of audiobooks and videos. You know, I'm a very audiovisual type of person. That's why I watch so many documentaries, and I'm always recommending people, you know, the latest documentary to learn about what is happening with water, which I mentioned before. And then lastly, you mentioned again, one of those was when I just rewatched Bill Gates' interview from like 5 years ago when he told us that, you know, the next most dangerous thing before climate change was a pandemic, and people just don't listen. So it's fascinating, if not sad, you know, combined. So very, very good points. Thank you for that, Craig. And the last two, one is, you know, it's a high level, but, you know, the name of the podcast is Impact Leader. So I ask guests, what is a leader? You know, what is an impact leader to you?
I think an impact leader is someone who is pushing probably a new area or to come up with a solution set for impact, which hasn't been done yet. And we've covered lots of ways that can happen today. But I think a leader is not somebody who just is jumping on the bandwagon again, and that can be fine. But it's being on the edge, coming up with new solutions, trying to bring impact to places it hasn't gone, and which can be raising capital solutions. It can be deploying innovative solutions. Again, I think there are some impact leaders with amazing technologies and companies. They're impact leaders. And I think, you know, for someone like me, as we've talked about, if I'm a leader, I have to also lead by experience. And there are those of us who may have come, not been pure impact investors our whole lives, but we have to lead by mentoring and encouraging. And I think that's another aspect of it.
Giving back, pay forward, right?
Yeah.
And one last call to action for everyone and anyone.
Go for it, guys. Do it. We passion. There's so many, as we've just touched today. Wow. There's so many incredible areas. And I get excited every day with get some of these companies I'm dealing with. And dealing with creative technologies, dealing with which can bring so many solutions. There's so many amazing opportunities. Do we have challenges? We got challenges. They're scary. But I get confident because I know the solutions are out there. And as we've said a bunch of times, JP, you've said, just like we're evolving standards, we're evolving solutions. We're seeing problems, but we're coming up with things. So I'd say, please go for it. I get more excited when I've talked about mentoring. I mean, just do it. We need you to do it.
Thank you for that. And if people want to contact you, what is the best way?
The best way is to get in touch with me, probably with my assistant at Pegasus. And that's the best way. I get lots of emails. I try to respond to them. I can't always. With technology, I'll end up in spam. But the best way is probably to just reach out to my assistant at Pegasus. Yeah.
I'm going to pick on you. It's definitely not through LinkedIn, guys, because he's got about like 10 contacts. So,
yeah, it's too much. Technology is wonderful, but the best way for me is actually to have my assistant get my attention.
I'm jealous of people that do not use LinkedIn. Mine is about to explode right now.
Well, that's it could. So I've learned, and part of it is I want to be able to respond, but with LinkedIn, I won't end up responding and then I'll feel guilty, which I don't want to do.
Craig, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate your time, especially you are away right now. So it's a real, real pleasure and a real honor.
It's an honor to be with you, and thank you for what you're doing. What you're doing is wonderful to publicize the opportunities in this area and the need for people to be investing in impact. So thank you. Look forward to our next conversation on or off the podcast.
Me too. And on that note that you mentioned, you know, before I go, I did want to take this opportunity to invite people to partner with me and with Impact Leaders. You know, we want to help and do more to raise awareness and create action. That is from the first time I talked to you, I share that with you. So we are looking for these three kind of founder sponsors to, for the first time, you know, to support kind of our mission to enable the transition of capital into sustainable impact investing. And we're also looking for 10 impact leaders interested to join a program that we're going to launch. So please reach out to us and to me via our contacts page at ilmpartners.com, or there's another link called bit.ly. /IL Club if you want to register your interest. So that's it. Bye for now. Until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA and Partners. Please connect with us to work together in the transition of capital into sustainable and impact investing. If you would like to support the podcast more specifically, we will be soon launching the Supercast and Patreon subscriptions. Or email podcast@ilmpartners.com to become a sponsor or patron.